Hi, this is Bob Wells here, and welcome to Undercurrent Stories. This is the show where we hear about people's interests and uncover some fascinating stories at the same time. I hope you enjoy today's show. Hello, and welcome to Undercurrent Stories. In today's show, I'm joined by Jason Sinclair. Jason has been in finance throughout his working life. He's now a group finance director, and he's just published his first book. Now, it's not a book about finance. In fact, his first book is a children's book called Weird Bob, A Tall Story. Hello and welcome to the show, Jason.
Hi, Bob, and thank you for having me.
No, it's great. I think we got to know each other through LinkedIn, so it's a useful platform now and again.
Yes, a mutual friend from my days at Howth Timber, I think.
Mr. Duncan Barker. Know him very well. A little shout out there for Duncan. So thank you very much for coming on the show. It's great to have you on. I just ought to make it clear that the book title, Weird Bob, is nothing to do with me.
Yeah, indeed.
Okay. Before we talk about your book, can you just please tell us a bit about yourself, you know, your life's journey and what you do in your current role, please?
Yeah, no problem. As you say, a career accountant, and I can almost pinpoint the moment the journey started, really. I remember being at school in what was the fifth year now, year 11, I think, in New Money. And I knew what I didn't want to do, and that was anything that was practical. I'd already given up the metalwork and woodwork as soon as I could, really, and you could say I was practically useless because I was not very good at anything practical. So I knew I didn't want to go down that route, but I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And I remember the local college, Bracknell College, came in and did a talk about what they did, and they offered a suite of A-levels, law, accounts and economics. And I thought, well, blimey, if I can't do something with those A-levels, then there's probably not much hope for me. So off I went to the local sixth form college and did law, accounts and economics. And my mum was very keen for me to go to university. She didn't go herself. And I think there's part of her that felt that it was more the experience than the actual education, if you like. And she was keen for me to go. And so when I was applying for university places, it was the accounts course that I'd enjoyed, or the first year of the A-levels that I'd enjoyed the most. I think that sort of natural getting things to balance your debits and your credits, it sort of suits my personality, if you like. So I applied to do accountancy at university, and I think from there was only one way I was going. So from university, yeah, so went straight into industry as opposed to audit. But I think that was probably the only decision I had to make as to which sort of side of the accountancy route I went down, and went into industry straight from uni. So that's where it started.
And it's interesting. It's interesting talking to people how many people get into a career based on very similar things that you did, which is basically you knew you didn't want to do that, and you sort of narrow it down into something that's sort of vaguely interesting.
Yeah, and I think I've not regretted it for a second, and it suits my personality, as in I'm logical, which helps if you're logical when you're in accounts. I pretty much enjoyed every minute of it, really. I've been to places that I would never have been otherwise, seen things I would never have seen, all thanks to sort of my career choice on day one, if you like. So,
what countries have you been to with your career?
Well, probably in the mid-noughties, about 2005 to 2008, I was working for Cape Industrial Services, who were industrial service providers to primarily the oil and gas sector, did scaffolding and insulation. And I got moved across from the UK side of the business to the international side. So we had operations in the Middle East, the Far East, Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan, even Sakhalin Island, which is a Russian island off their east coast, so north of Japan. So that was a fair old trek to get to. I did go there once, and I think they have temperatures of minus 30 in the winter and plus 30 in the summer. So I made sure I went in the spring, where it was just above freezing. So, seeing places like that was...
That must have been really interesting.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I think flying through Moscow and getting a 10-hour Aeroflot flight from Moscow to Sakhalin Island was probably the most memorable bit about it. Yeah,
Yeah, well, what an opportunity, though, because I don't think most people would even know where it is.
No, I'd certainly not heard of it before. but yeah, it was, you know, the snow pile up the side of the road was still there, sort of 10 feet high. We did have an English guy out there running our accounts, who spoke fluent Russian, so I didn't have to sort of worry about the language. But yeah, seeing all the sort of the old, it's almost 60s Russian apartment blocks still there, and you sort of think, Christ, how do people survive in minus 30 when in those sort of very bleak looking buildings? But it's quite an experience. But I think the place that I enjoyed the most, probably, I'd love to go back as a tourist almost, was Baku in Azerbaijan.
Oh, yeah.
Which was partly an old walled city, so it had the history from, you know, over 1,000 years ago. But it also, you could walk down one street and there'd be the old imposing Russian era, Soviet era buildings. Then there'd be sort of almost a derelict building, and then there'd be the 21st century hotel that's been built with the oil money that came in to Azerbaijan sort of 25, 30 years ago. And so it was a real contrast. And I think since then, obviously, they've developed a lot. They've had Eurovision Song Contest. They've had European Championship football and that. So it's probably come a long way since I went in sort of 15, 20 years ago. So, but I'd like to go back there. So yeah, I've seen a few places I wouldn't have otherwise. You know, Middle East, Far East. Get some good experiences there whilst you're working. You don't always get to see a huge amount sort of between hotels and offices.
No.
But did get to see the pyramids in Cairo. We had a conference in Cairo. We had a night trip to see the pyramids at Giza. It was dark, so we couldn't sort of go right up to them, but they did a light show. So they had a light show on the side of the pyramid, sort of giving the history of the pharaohs and so on.
Wow.
So yeah, it's been rewarding, I think, as a career. And I think in the thing I like about the role is you get to see all aspects of the business. So in my current role, you're looking at the commercial stuff, you're looking at insurance, you're looking at pensions, you're looking at banking. So you do get to see an overview of what's going on in the business,
which I
find interesting.
And the current company you work for is ADS. And tell us a bit about that, because I know that you mentioned something to do with the Farnborough Air Show, which I think listeners would be interested in.
Yeah, so ADS Group is the trade body for aerospace, defence, security and space. Probably not that well known.
That's a UK company.
UK company, yeah. So we focus on the UK sectors for those aerospace, defence, security and space, working on their behalf as a sort of a go-between, or if you like, between the industry and government. So I wouldn't say, hesitate you to use the words lobbyist. You've probably heard that bandied around a bit with CBI recently.
Yeah.
But we kind of do similar work with the government. I think we're conveners, I think, rather than lobbyists in so much as we do work for the government as well as for the industry. But a bit that people will probably be aware of, or potentially aware of, is that we've got 100% owned subsidiary called Farnborough International, and they're an events and exhibitions business, and most well known for running the Farnborough International Air Show, which is every 2 years. Obviously, up until 2018, it's predominantly in a trade show. So 5 days, Monday to Friday, is a trade show. And then Saturday and Sunday used to be a public air show.
Yeah.
But the last episode of that was in 2018. And unfortunately, due to a number of reasons, we had to stop doing that, partly because of tightening of health and safety rules on air shows. And the following the accident at Shoreham, I think that was about 8 years ago, there was a lot tighter restrictions placed on fast jets flying over built up areas. And of course, we're sort of right in the middle of Farnborough, so it now restricts what sort of displays we can have on at Farnborough. And of course, you can't really have an air show without the red arrows and so on. So I think 2018, people were finding there were paying money for an air show ticket and then not seeing the air show that they thought they were going to see. So it's a combination of that and obviously people sort of falling away. The sales really were falling away as well because of that. So it was a bit of a chicken and egg.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, we had to cancel that. But we're still a five-day trade show, still one of the biggest in the country. We had 80,000 visitors coming through the doors in 5 days last year.
And these would be, and is it military and civil?
Yes, yeah, very much.
So if I worked for an airline, I wanted to buy 10 Boeings or something, I'd come along, would I?
Was absolutely, just, yeah. So we have Airbus and Boeing are the two biggest exhibitors or attendees, if you like.
Yeah.
And the show is built around them. But it is 70% or so overseas exhibitors. So it's an international show. And that's what we sort of try and strive towards. But it brings that sort of hopefully investment into the country and keeps our aerospace sector at the forefront of the world stage, if you like.
Yes.
So it's very much all about driving the UK economy as much as anything. So
yeah, it's still televised, I believe, isn't it?
Not national television. We have some cameras, and we do sort of news bulletins afterwards, so you can see some highlights of the day of what's happened. And we still do have flying at the event, but it's a lot more commercial aircraft primarily displaying more up and down rather than doing anything sort of too acrobatic.
I would guess if you're an air enthusiast, you would probably sort of camp yourself out somewhere near Farnborough, would you?
Yes, we do get a lot of that. And we do still sell tickets for the Friday. The Friday is now more about the next generation, so skills and this sort of, I think anyone under 21 can come in free. So we try and encourage the exhibitors to stay for the Friday and do a bit of sort of more of a careers themed day. So if you did want to come along, you can still come on a Friday.
So it'd be lots of talks and presentations rather than low flying jets.
It is more that way. Yeah. But it's well attended by, it's normally opened by the Prime Minister of the day. So we had Boris Johnson last summer. He just resigned from his post, so he was working his notice.
Awkward.
He was even more ebullient than normal, I think. He was on good form. I think he was sort of the relief of having handed your notice in almost, I think.
Yes.
So that was interesting. So, it's certainly well supported by politicians and because they obviously see the benefit of working with certainly one of the biggest sectors in the country.
How did you first get interested in writing?
It goes back to a story I used to tell my daughter sort of when she was, she's 21 now, so she probably won't forgive me for saying, but she was probably about 11 or 12 and we got in. And she was at that age where she was probably too old for having a bedtime story, but she still needed corralling into bed, if you know what I mean, of an evening. So I was supervising toothbrushing and getting ready for bed. And she said, tell me a story, Dad. But make one up. She used to quite like it when I made one up.
And she set you a challenge.
Yeah, I think she did like to set me a challenge as much as she actually liked the stories.
Yeah,
which were probably a variable quality, I would imagine. But this one was came along. I think it's like, let's start again. But I wouldn't class myself as a writer. It's very generous of you to call me one. I would say I'm someone who has written down a story I told my daughter. I think that's really out of respect for real writers, to be honest. I do like reading, and I put a book down and I think, how does someone put 300 or 400 pages together coherently like that? And I'm kind of in awe of a good writer. So it's not something I could ever do myself. So I think from that perspective, I think to describe me as a writer would be a little bit of a generous description. But so going back to picking up where we sort of told stories to my daughter, it's always trying to, a bit like a little lie. It's easier if you've got some element of truth around it.
Yeah.
So having that story about evolution as being the sort of core post to hang my hat on, if you like, and you look at the giraffe as the example in the story, where how on earth did they get a long neck, and for example, and trying to make up a story around, well, obviously in this case he was reaching up for the highest branches of a tree and he was stretching his neck and so on. Yeah. and it was that sort of concept that got me going with the story of Weird Bob. So, and it became a bit of a family legend after that. I'm not sure why, but Kate, who's my youngest, was obviously enjoyed that one, and we sort of talk about it, and then it sort of started to talk to friends and so on. They said, that's a really good idea, and probably it was either 2020, I think, or maybe even 2021, finally got down to writing it down. I mean, it's a side of A4, perhaps, so it probably took about 20 minutes. But
yeah.
I gave it to a friend who was a teacher, and they sort of read it out to her class. I think she taught 5 or 6 year olds, so yeah. She was teaching the target audience, and she came back and said, "You probably want to change the end, because I'd mentioned about them having babies."
Oh,
and
that's right.
And the kids were like, "Oh no, babies, miss, that's disgusting." So it became a slightly more generic finish. So that's how giraffes are as they are today, sort of thing. But so having written it down, I sort of sent a copy to both my daughters. My oldest daughter's 25 now, and then for Christmas 21, they presented me with a PDF of the book as it is now. So they'd sort of gone on to, I think, an online, a Canva type website where you can design covers and books and presentations and so on. And they'd come up with the book. So, and they'd also said, right, and this is an address or an email contact for someone who can get it published. So,
still challenging you.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. That's daughters for you, I suppose. But I contacted, it was Author House, and, it's a self-published book, obviously, so I did actually have to make a small payment to Author House for them to sort of get it into print and put it out there online. And it's now available to buy as a fully furnished book. So
it's designed for or the target audience, the demographic, are sort of 4 to 5 year olds.
Yes, it's early sort of readers. Yeah.
And it talks about evolution. Can you just expand on that a bit, please?
Yeah, so as I say, it was trying to find a concept there I could sort of build a story around. And if you look at all sorts of animals, they're fascinating in how you sort of think, how on earth did they become to look like that?
Yeah.
And I think the giraffe there is quite an obvious example, in so much as it's how tall it is, and it looks so ungainly, but it still sort of manages to run around the African plains. So it was a nice, easy one to sort of start with. And I like the sort of history books and quite interested in all the David Attenborough programs and all that sort of thing. So it was quite a nice way to create a story. And of course, Weird Bob also has that sort of element of him being teased for being different. So it brought in that aspect of, I wouldn't say bullying, but it's that sort of teasing for being slightly different. But yeah, he then becomes the hero of the day and manages to get the nice juicy leaves at the top of the tree that no one else can reach. So so actually it sort of celebrates that difference.
And, yeah. Does he have the longest neck in
exactly
his
yes so right, so he okay. he is born with this sort of longer neck than all the rest of the giraffes. So and they sort of tease him for being slightly different, and but as it comes out, it turns out to be an advantage, and he sort of helps all the rest of the herd, and he gets rewarded by the chief elephant.
It sounds great. I think my 3-year-old grandson probably in a few months' time might be quite interested in that.
Yeah, and I think whilst it's a sort of 5 to 6 or whatever for readers, I think you can tell that story to kids before they can read. I know we certainly sort of told stories to our daughters from the minutes that they sort of got home from hospital. It was bath, story, bed, and that was the routine from day one, really. So
nothing like a bit of bribery.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. And where can people, if any listeners are interested in this book, where can they get hold of it?
It's certainly on Amazon. So if you type in Weird Bob, Jason Sinclair, it will pop up. But Author House have their own website, so you can buy it on there. And I think it's even on Telegraph Books. So it's all on the online. It's not in any stores.
I'll put all those links in the show notes, Jason, if anybody's interested.
Thank you very much.
So Do you find that you can use story? I mean, obviously, you've thought some of that through, and well, you've thought it all through in terms of storytelling. Do you use storytelling at all in any other way?
I mean, certainly, as in my role as finance director, you're always storytelling to a certain extent.
Well, you mean the story behind good or bad numbers, do you mean?
Exactly, and you've got different audiences. So a board report is essentially the story of the business financials and cash flow, but you're sort of fairly serious in that sort of scenario, so a bit more wordy, the odd graph or whatever to illustrate the numbers, but it's a serious report. But then at the other end of the extreme, we have a sort of Christmas party, and it starts with an hour and a half of presentations, of which finance always get a slot. The audience, 150 people, are sort of looking at their watch thinking, right, in an hour's time, it's lunch and Prosecco. I'm not really that interested in what the CEO or the FD has got to say today. So you have to make it engaging. So so I try and challenge myself to do a finance presentation or finance update without any numbers. So that's become the theme. So last Christmas, I did a 12 days of Christmas and changed it to the 12 ADSs of Christmas and picked 12 sort of highlights from the year, and sort of left an envelope on each of the tables. There was actually 13 tables, but so 12 of them got an envelope, and on the 12th day, someone from table 12 got up, read out the achievement of the business, and then on the presentation will be a couple of bullet points around that particular event, and so hopefully that engaged everyone. And then if they weren't listening, I got them to sing it at the end.
Oh, really?
We got everybody up and singing on the 12th day of Christmas. It wasn't my true love. It was "You Unruly Lot Gave to Me" or something. So it's just finding ways to sort of keep the audience engaged, and it's certainly storytelling plays a large part of that. So
that's great to see the creativity that you've got coming out in that way.
Yeah, I think particularly in those scenarios where you know the audience have got other things on their mind. It's a Christmas party coming up in an hour.
What am I going to wear?
Well, they're already dressed, but they're right. Dressed for a party, so they're ready. They're already thinking about 12:30 or whatever. The drinks are served, and having that engagement in another way, and the feedback is always generally, thank God you did a presentation like that, because otherwise I would probably have not been listening. And
what were there any, obviously coming from the corporate world, you must have seen a lot of presentations. Were there any particular presentations that sort of inspired you to go about it that way?
Not particularly. I think I do read a lot of the sort of county magazines, and they always do talk about storytelling. You can't go too long before you see another article on the art of presentations in these magazines. So it is a fairly common topic of discussion. But I wouldn't say there was a particular presentation. Probably the other way around. The fact that I've sat through so many presentations where even I thought, Christ, this is dull. And, I hope I don't force my audience to sit through something like this. So it's probably the other way around, as opposed to seeing one that I've thought, wow, that's fantastic. Obviously, you do get a range, and some of them are a lot more engaging than others. But, probably the ones that have had the biggest effect are the ones where you've actually thought, oh, I hope I don't do it like that. A bit like you probably learn more from your mistakes than you do from your successes. But
absolutely, So again, you were sort of inspired by what you didn't want to see.
Yes, absolutely.
To turn it right around the other way, which sounds really great. I mean, you mentioned a bit earlier on about you're not a writer. However, you've published a book, and there may be some listeners out there who perhaps have got a little idea and perhaps don't regard themselves as a writer. What sort of advice would you give them?
I mean, having actually seen it in print, the book, I mean, you do feel a sense of achievement. So I think you've got an idea. There are more than one ways of getting it published. I mean, I didn't really realise that you could sort of give yourself a foot up by doing it yourself, sort of thing. And it was very easy. The fact that my daughters had sort of done all the graphics and the artwork made it even easier. But, they talked you right the way through the process. So if you do have a burning desire to see your book in print or and on online for sale, then it is easier than you think. I'd say go for it, really. I mean, I leave it for others to judge as to whether I classify as a writer and the quality of the story in this case. But most of the feedback's been pretty good, so I would certainly sort of encourage people if they've got that desire to get their first book off the ground.
Well, I have to ask you this question as a finance director. How are the numbers doing?
Well, I must be into sort of near 20 sales, I think, just judging by people who said they bought the book. You know, that's mainly family, but a fair few friends from work. So yeah. I think at £2 a book, I could almost afford a night out soon. So
wow.
It's going strong. Although I suspect now that everyone's bought their copy, sales might tail off somewhat.
Well, that was going to lead to my next question. Are you planning any subsequent books?
Well, there's a couple of ideas. When I did put Weird Bob down into writing the giraffe story, there were a couple of others. There was a penguin and a chameleon. So they're sort of drafted out. So let's see how Weird Bob, the tall excellent. Story goes. And there might be Weird Bob the penguin coming out soon. You never know.
Well, it's been great talking to you, Jason. I'll put the links on your book on the show notes if anybody's interested in purchasing the book and finding out a bit more. Have you got any other projects coming up?
I'm a bit of a runner, so I've got a 100K run coming up in June, so just starting to train for that. I do like the ultra runs, try and get one in a year at least, so that's my one for this year, and then hopefully get a marathon in at the end of the year. So that's kind of my projects, if you like.
Is that for charity?
Yes, we're doing the one in June for Brookfield School. It's a school for children with learning disabilities in Reading. So yeah. It's part of the running club that I'm a member of. We have a charity each year, so that's our chosen charity for this year. So yes, I'll be doing that. I'll get a page on Just Giving or Virgin Money at some point in the next couple of weeks, and we'll be doing it for that.
Well, that's great too, and I'll put that up, you know, if you've got the link fairly quickly, I can put that on the show notes for people if anybody's interested in supporting that cause. Anyway, lovely talking to you, Jason, and have a good day.
Yeah, thanks very much, Paul. Thank you.
You have been listening to Undercurrent Stories. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Please feel free to share the show link to your friends and family. And if you have 60 seconds, I will be most grateful if you would please rate and review. To hear more episodes, please subscribe to the show and visit undercurrentstories.com. If you leave your email in the link, we will notify you as soon as new episodes are released. Also, check out our social media links, details of which can be found on the show notes. Until next time, this is Bob Wells wishing you all the very best.